What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 96, Dermatology for Sports Medicine Professionals, with Dr. Alicia Bedgood. Dr. Bedgood is not a dermatologist, but she sees dermatology issues regularly in her office, and so she is someone that deals with sports medicine and someone that can kind of bridge the gap between a regular office doctor, a dermatologist, and a sports medicine doctor, and puts it all together to talk about some of the issues in dermatology that we face here in sports medicine, especially in athletic training and dealing with athletes. So you will definitely enjoy this conversation. And again, her slideshow should be on the links there in the show notes, so you can check those out. I am Jeremy Jackson for the Sports Medicine Broadcast. And again, I want to thank Morgan Wilson for letting us use her music, J.J. Worthen for letting us use his music, Dr. Josh Yellen and Dr. Mark Knobloch for doing most of the interviews, and then Bob Marley and his group for letting us record at the 13th Annual Sports Medicine Update. Check us out on the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. Again, check us out on the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, where you can rate it on iTunes or wherever you find it so that other people can find it as well. Definitely interact with us. Tell us who you want to hear from, what you want to hear about. One of our most popular ones so far was the ice or not to ice with Josh Stone and Steve Canelli. So we might go back to that format where we have an expert on both sides of the story, just kind of defending their case. So if you got somebody or a topic that you want addressed like that, then again, let me know on the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. It has all the way to contact me, all the information there, at PHS Sports Med on Twitter. My email, my phone number is all there. So definitely look it up, check us out, get in touch with us. Thanks for listening.
Something that you see almost never to something you're going to see pretty much every day. Skin issues in your kids. We all know high school kids, middle school kids do not have the greatest hygiene, so this is going to come up a lot. The skin is also, and I apologize, now I have to wake up. The skin is one of the largest organs in the body, so it encompasses a lot of things. People don't always understand that your hair, your nails, all of that is included in the same system in the skin, so we're going to talk about that a little bit today too. So athletes, they process nutrients and they also lose nutrients from the skin. So that makes it something that's very included in the care of the athlete. The symptoms are often related to the things that we see with sports, but they also may be related to the things that are outside of sports. Are they taking medications, particularly kids who are Ritalin? It's going to make them more dehydrated. Kids that are on acne medication make them more sensitive to the sun. We need to know all those things about their history to be able to properly address the issues with the skin. So these are a couple of the things that we're going to go through and talk about today and kind of touch on. This is not going to be all-inclusive. I just love this little thing here. It says, hey kid, want to be a super bug? Stick some of this into your genome. Eat a penicillin, won't be able to hurt you. And it was a shortcut through the hospital kitchen, and Albert was first approached by a member of the antibiotic resistance. We don't want to be throwing antibiotics at just anything, but we want to be able to be treating our kids appropriately. So the NCAA has been really good in the last probably 5 to 10 years about trying to deal with infections of the skin. And they put out a lot of these great posters, and hopefully you'll have some of these up at your school. What we're going to talk about is these skin infections. You're going to see them more in your wrestlers, your football players, your really sweaty guys who touch each other a lot. So it's often passed, actually, even though they touch each other a lot in contact, most of the time it can be spread through towels and sharing of towels. That's a great, moist, warm environment for these bugs to grow. So we have to be really aware of that. They did an NCAA, or in the NFL, they took a study where they actually monitored and made them keep their own towels. They would monitor when they were put in the baskets, make sure they got washed, make sure they weren't sharing, and their risk of infection dramatically decreased. So it's a huge part of that. They're also starting now to make locker room material that's impregnated with antibiotic material to try and decrease the sharing of those from one to another on those surfaces. They're really expensive at this point and not really mainstream, but it's something that may be coming in the future. These things can quickly become outbreaks. They can pass from athlete to athlete, and a lot of times they have an incubation period or a couple days where the kid may not know that they're infected, or they think they just got a cut or a scratch and it's not a big deal. And in that time period, they may have transmitted that to 3, 4, 5 other people. That's where my lovely rabbits are here, because that's about what these infections spread like. Tinea corpus and PETA's impetigo, MRSA, herpes warts, those are the things that we need to focus the most on. So our funguses, our Tinea corpus and our Tinea PETA's, they're spread through skin-to-skin contact. Sweaty, broken down skin, particularly on the feet, in the, if you're in a helmet, around the wear of the helmet, or the straps are, those are the places that are most susceptible, because you're going to get breaks in the skin that you may not always see, but that bugs can crawl into. The difference is, so when we think of the athlete's foot, we think of the, you know, everybody's got the ugly toenails. It's actually a different fungus that tends to affect the head. And the rest of the body. This is an example of what it looks like as a Tinea corporis. So you may notice, and our guys have really, really short hair as well, the ones that shave their head. It's even more likely because they disrupt the hair follicles when they're doing that shaving, and it's a lot easier for that fungus to get in. The other thing about that is the head and the scalp is a lot harder to treat. You have to do a lot longer course of antibiotics to really be effective, and it can cause more problems with the liver. So we want to try and avoid the spread if we can. We want to be on the preventative side of it and not on the trying to catch up and treat it side. If you see athletes with any of these fungal lesions, if it can't be covered, they can't play. When you're doing the wrestling or the wrestling checks, they need to be in a sports bras or shorts for all of your athletes, men and women, because you have to be able to see the skin. That's really, really important. For the tinea pedis and the athletes, the socks that are wicking, the ones that have where you can put the powder, those actually do help to prevent transmission. But you got to be really, really diligent about it, and they need to change their socks. If they're going from practice in the morning to class and then practice in the afternoon and they're wearing the same socks, they're going to have problems, and not just with the girls. Topical treatments. So treatments of fungus. So if it is just an open skin lesion and something that you can get a good topical cream on, it needs 72 hours of treatment before they can play, unless it's covered. If they can cover it, it's fine, but we need to get 72 hours of treatment. Scalp lesions, the ones that I was talking about that are really difficult to treat, those need 2 weeks of treatment, and there's probably not a way that you're going to be able to cover a scalp lesion appropriately for them to be able to get out there. So the sooner you recognize these, the sooner those kids are going to be able to get back to play and competition, and they're going to be a lot happier with you. These are the recommendations for both USA Wrestling as well as NCAA. Those with a solo or extensive lesion that can't be covered, they have to be disqualified. I can't say that enough, because this can turn into a huge epidemic really quickly. The ones that we think of that can't be covered are going to be particularly around the mouth as well as the nose. Herpes, this one's fun too. And this one can't be treated like the funguses can. So this one is even more important. This a lot of times can just look like a scratch at first, and it looks a little bit mad and angry at you, but really be on high alert. They're going to be in clustered little lesions. With an erythema in the face or a nice red base, this is an excellent example of what they look like. And again, this is something that is not going to go away, so parents are not very happy when they find out their kid has been infected with it. I actually have one of my players currently who was a wrestler in high school, and he's now showing up with worsening with lesions for the first time, but he was probably infected at a much younger age. the best way, if you are unsure about what this is, doing a Zinc smear, having one of your physicians do a Zinc smear and send it. It doesn't take that long to get back, and then you have a definitive result. This is better for when you're trying to rule it out. So if you want to make absolutely sure that this is not what it is and get somebody back to competition, don't make the mistake of putting them out there and having them spread something that is going to be a lifelong problem. Just go ahead, get it checked. If it's negative, they can play. If not, hold them out so you can get that further testing, or you can see what this lesion is going to look like in a couple of days if you're unsure. And just in terms of herpes in general, even with people who have this, there is still a 5% risk of transmission, even when people don't have lesions. Mostly that's a sexual transmission, but it can be transmitted through asymptomatic shedding. So even when people are not having lesions, it's not completely safe. So treatment, they need to have, they're allowed to play if they have no systemic symptoms. Sometimes with a first outbreak can be associated with kind of flu-like symptoms. They may just feel like they're not feeling great. And, oh, by the way, I also have this little spot here. No new lesions within 72 hours, and they need to have at least 120 hours of antiviral on board. This is a medication that they have to take several times a day, 3 to 4 times a day. So it's really important to get them on that quickly and get them taking it regularly. And for the recurrences, you just have to have the 3 and 4 because they usually don't have those same kind of flu-like symptoms at first. Warts, another fun thing that can last a long time, but not necessarily your entire life, caused by the papillomavirus. Usually it's on hands and feet. You typically know what this looks like, but sometimes it can be confused for a callus. If you're unsure, scrape a little bit of that callus off, and you'll see these little black dots. That's the I'm a wart sign. The way to treat it, they need to be frozen off if they're really bad. Some of those over-the-counter ones can take care of very, very small warts if you catch them early, but they're not the best. The other thing that you can have kids do, which is actually interesting, is put duct tape on them and then scrub them down in the morning. So put duct tape on them at night, open it up in the morning, scrub it down. Sometimes that'll actually cause enough of a reaction within the skin that the body starts to fight the infection itself. You still want them covered and so that they're not passing them on to other people. So multiple lesions on the face, that's definitely something that needs to be covered. You need to be making sure that you're cleaning all of the equipment properly, particularly for those ones on the face, where if they're sharing equipment where the warts are exposed. You want to do this a couple weeks if they're going to have treatment. Do it a couple weeks before, because it does make the area sore and blister, and you don't want somebody going into an area that is particularly with wrestling, where they've got lesions that have been blistering and sore, and it's just going to be very uncomfortable for them and put them at more risk for different kinds of infections. And they have shown that shoe wear and showers can help prevent the transmission of this. Probably our most common thing that we're going to see is the bacterial infection, so your cellulitis, your folliculitis. This is particularly prominent. This is the showering, where they go in, they splash some water on themselves, they, you know, play around and joke around with people for a while and come back out and think they're clean. This, like I said, again, decreased towel sharing makes a big, big difference on this. In your kids that are having multiple infections with this, I will actually have them do a HipaCleanse kind of body wash. So the HipaCleanse is really easy to get over the counter. Take it, have them scrub it down, leave it on for a few seconds, and then rinse it off. Do that a couple times a week. And it really helps to cut down on these guys who are coming in every other week with infections, so that we're not having to do the antibiotics on them on a regular basis. The other really important thing with this can lead to significant side effects. Most of the time they think, okay, they get it, we treat it with antibiotics, it's going to be fine. But there can be some serious side effects associated with it that cause renal disease and other issues, as well as just the pain and the misgames that they have if they're unable to play. like I said, treatment for this. You want to make sure that you're using the antibiotic that's best for the bugs that tend to be in your area. Most of your doctors should be aware of this, but a lot of the hospitals will provide it. Around here, it tends to be Bactrim. Bactrim's really good for the bugs that we tend to grow. But if you have somebody, a kid who's coming back frequently or they're just not feeling well when they're on the antibiotics, you need to get a culture sent so that they know exactly where they're going. Sometimes kids grow funny things. Other infections, Pitocuronolysis. This is actually a really interesting one. This would happen a lot in people who are those really, really sweaty kids who are wearing shoes a lot or in shoes, particularly soccer cleats, that don't breathe a lot. And the bacteria actually starts to break down the skin and cause these pits. And it also releases kind of a sulfur smell as the skin is breaking down. So if you see that, the best thing to do for this is really good cleansing, make sure that the skin is staying more dry. It doesn't need a ton of antibiotics, but it can take a little while to heal. The Pseudomonas folliculitis, so hot tubs or our warm tubs, our kids who are coming back from being on vacation in Padre Island and we're spending a lot of time in the pool. The Pseudomonas is a type of bacteria that loves water. And you can end up with the folliculitis like this, particularly on the legs if they're shaving for a sport, or just have irritation in those follicles. This actually goes away on its own. It doesn't necessarily need a bunch of antibiotics, so it just looks a lot scarier than it actually is. But be aware of it when you see it. It's not an allergic reaction. This is a inflammation of the follicle. And then also be aware that Galveston and the Bayou have all kinds of fun things in them. So if your kid comes in and is having a very unusual skin issue, like this one below, where you're getting blisters, you're getting there are some crazy things that can happen around Houston, and you want to get them to the appropriate medical provider quickly, because these can turn into things that are bad if they have a history of being in a body of water that's not necessarily clean recently. You need to get them somewhere quick. So exposure. So our skin is our protector, and it has to protect us against a lot of different things in Texas. Both environmental and equipment can be big issues. So I've had kids who have had allergic reactions to field turf, to tape, to the markings on the field. There is all kinds of interesting things that you can react to out there, both equipment and just the environment that we're in. Like I said, there's calcium oxide in the field markings, there's fibroblasts in hockey sticks, that adhesive we all know, latex. So just be aware of when somebody's getting a little red and irritated in a particular area, try and figure out what those triggers are. What were they recently exposed to that they weren't exposed to before? And in what areas is it? Is it in an area where they have clothing covering, or is it only in the areas where there's not clothing covering? Is it only on the side that they wear their glove and not on the side that they throw in? Those things make a difference. So urticaria. We think of this as hives. We think of it as a reaction to something. It can also be a reaction to the sun or cold. There are people who, whenever they get into a cold environment, develop these welts, and actually can even have trouble breathing. It's characterized by a very well-defined rash, and usually resolves on its own. But Zyrtec is actually a very, very good medication for this. If you have someone who knows that they have hives, the Zyrtec, even above and beyond the Allegra and the Claritin, is a great medication. It can make them sleepy and it can make them dehydrated, so make sure they're taking it at night and drinking extra water. So that's going to be your best option for this. And they can actually take that either as a when they have the hives, or they can take it as a preventative type of medication if they're having them on a regular basis. This is kind of a hives on steroids. Exercise-induced anaphylaxis, and that's when you get these hives, you get these itching, but they're also associated with respiratory problems. And this can happen just from running outside or doing an activity in a particular type of environment. So it may present itself almost like asthma, but if it continues to happen, it's worsening, it needs to be addressed. And the best way to treat it when it gets really bad, obviously, is to, with vascular support, get them to somewhere where they've got, if they need to, they can be trached or have an endotracheal tube placed if necessary, if for some reason they go into a respiratory collapse. This, the other important thing about this is it responds much better to antihistamines and EpiPens or epinephrine than it does to bronchodilators. So if you've got that person, like I said, it kind of looks like asthma, but they have no history of asthma, and they're not responding to an albuterol inhaler, just have this kind of in the back of your mind there. So other issues, blisters and calluses. At the bottom here is my favorite quote from Stick It. If you've never watched it, it's an excellent movie about gymnastics. So calluses are a hypertrophic area of skin. It's usually from long-term stress. So usually something that you're doing over and over and over again. Whereas blisters may occur the first time that you actually do that activity and are an area of acute friction. So we see this in our pictorial weight lifters. The calluses are actually protective to the hand, whereas the blisters may be a detriment because if they've got that nice open skin wound, it's not very comfortable, and at the site it can get infected and cause more problems. Leather pads, gloves, those are really good things to help protect it against these. And it's not a handy thing to wear gloves. A lot of times I have to, tell my kids that girls are not going to want to hold hands with you if you have really, really calloused hands, so go ahead and put the gloves on. I deal with a lot of boys. So I apologize if I'm a little skewed with the... So more blisters and calluses. With your runners, you don't necessarily think of them and having as many of these problems, but this can happen if they're running long enough, even in our younger runners. Feet blisters definitely make a difference, and if you don't want them trying on a new pair of shoes and going for a long run, you want to really wear those shoes in a little bit first. Well-fitting clothes, both the loose or the tight clothes can make a difference in terms of blistering. There's not lots of really, really good creams for this, but Vaseline works fabulous. It's nice and cheap. Get it in all of those areas, whether it be around the areas of the sports bra, around the nipples, in between the thighs, all of those areas where you're going to get those chafings in the long run. And also moisture wicking is a really important part of this as well. Acne. This is particularly in our middle school and high school kids because they are very, very image conscious. It's worsened in our athletes because of friction. So areas where they have rubbing, so any of our people who have helmets on, and they've got that area where it's rubbing all around along here, on the back of wearing a sports bra in the girls or pads in the guys, those are going to be areas where they have to worry about this more. And getting them to actually wash their face when they go in after practice, big deal, makes a big difference. The other thing that makes a big difference is exfoliation, because when they're sweating and they're sloughing off all that loose skin, it actually blocks the pores and causes problems. So if we can use an exfoliant to get rid of some of that loose skin, they're less likely to have those pores blocked. The other big thing is the medication over-the-counter benzoyl peroxide is excellent for acne, and you can find it in a lot of the over-the-counter cleansers and cleaners. So that's what you want to point your kids towards, is the benzoyl peroxide. Nails are fun. So whatever is the longest toe is probably going to be the one you have a problem with. We all think, okay, well, the big toe, that's the one that's the issue. But a lot of people, their second toe is actually longer. So when you fit them for their shoes and you go down and you fit where their great toe is, go ahead and check where their second toe is, too, because it's going to be a victim if you only check the largest toe. So our cross-country runners, they're typically going to be the ones that their shoes are too loose, and their toe is actually jamming against the end, where because there's too much room, versus our soccer players who like to wear their shoes way too tight. And then they're getting compression of all of their toes in there, and every time they make a quick stop, their toe's going to bang into the front of that. So you can actually cause damage to the nail bed and get a lot of bleeding down in the nail bed if you have enough trauma of this, and I'm sure we've all seen those toes that are toenails falling off, in addition to all of our lovely infected toenails that we get. The other big thing with this is you want to make sure that the kids are cutting their toenails straight across and not arched, because when you arch those toenails, that's when you get the infected toenails that we then have to remove, and it's nice and painful, and nobody likes to use the toenails. So make sure when you're talking to your kids, if they've had repeated infections of their toenails and ingrown toenails, they want to be cutting straight across. And actually cutting their toenails. That's the other problem. Weather is a big thing. We see more of this, the burn side of this, than the chill. But if you're traveling somewhere, you need to be aware of the temperature where you're going to be. Just like people acclimatize to the heat, they also acclimatize to the cold. So you're more likely to get frostbite if you're in an area that's colder than normal. And people who live in that environment, their body actually has taught itself to remember to send circulation to those extremities. Whereas if you're new to that environment, the body hasn't had time to develop that sense, and you're much more likely to have kids with frostbite in those situations. Also, if it heats the sun, we want to make sure that we're watching out for sunburns. The ambient temperature. Tanning bed, that's the other thing with our kids, with the burn. A lot of our kids are doing tanning for the aesthetics of it. It's not any better for you than being out in the sun at practice all day. You know, it's nice to even out those tan lines, but you're still getting that UVA, UVB exposure. The other thing I wanted to point out is in our runners and our sports where they're moving pretty quickly, the ambient temperature, or the temperature that they're feeling, is decreased about 1.5 to 2 degrees per mile that they're running. So if you've got somebody who's running at an 8 to 9 minute mile per hour pace, it's actually about 15 degrees cooler than what we're feeling just standing out there. So that's something, and that does affect things like frostbite. So remember that when you're getting, when your kids are going out there in their little short shorts to run. In that 40 degree weather. So cool. Make sure you're keeping them nice and covered, and you're getting them warmed up afterwards as well. Okay. Renan, this is another cold weather phenomenon, but the reason I bring it up is that it can also be related to stress. So what it is it's a vasospasm in the fingers, and this is actually not in your data, like I understand. It's a vasospasm in the fingers that cuts off the circulation to the distal finger. And it can be caused with anxiety. I actually have a kid right now who he only gets it during games. Doesn't happen with practice, but as soon as that game is about to start, he starts getting tingly and having pain in his fingers. And being a basketball player, that doesn't really work so well when you get when it hurts every time the ball hits your hand. It's a pretty simple treatment for it. We just use nifedipine and dose it daily during the season. But it's something to be aware of when your kid comes in and it's kind of scary looking and they have no circulation in their fingers. Warm them up. Get them in to see their doctor. Make sure that there's not anything else going on, and then treat it, because it can be really detrimental to the performance if you leave it untreated. Hand cancer, this is the extreme of the burn side of things. You obviously aren't dealing with skin cancer, but you're dealing with shaping what kids are going to be like in the future. And so we need to be teaching them good habits now, and most of the skin damage that occurs in people happens when they're young. Those really bad burns that they're getting over the summer, also during sports, And so if we can teach them good habits and teach them good skin health now, they're going to be better off for the future. These are a couple of my favorite examples. This is my favorite soccer coach in her lovely soccer tan, as well as Phil Mickelson with his excellent hat tan there. And I have this picture of the Women's College World Series from last year up here, because sports that used to be sun-protected, wearing hat, baseball as well as softball, even if it was just a visor, they're really going to bows, which are a lot less protective against the sun these days. So they need to be more aware about really taking care of their skin. And just a couple of examples of what skin looks like. I know we've all heard these before, and you've got the A, B, C, D, and E. And one little picture here of the Hutchinson sign. If you look at the bottom of that streak on the nail, it actually goes all the way into the nail bed, and that's when we want to worry about skin cancer in the nail. And these are extremely aggressive forms of skin cancer, so important to be aware of. Even if a parent just comes up to you and says, hey, look at this, what do you think of this? Just a couple other random issues here. Talon-Moore and Mogul's palm are both very closely related. They're intradermal bleeding, either on the soles of the feet or on hand, where basically you get a little bleed in between the skin, and sometimes can be confused for skin cancer, but a really benign condition. So if it goes away, it may take several weeks to months to go away, it's okay. But if it stays there longer than that, then we need to get it checked out. And then these lovely papules, which are basically herniations of the fat. So you may not see it when they're just standing straight up or elevated, but once they put pressure onto the heels, you get these nice little herniations. And this can be pretty pretty painful, and it's also only correctable with surgery. So those are just a couple funny little weird skin things that I thought I'd share with you. And that is all I have today. Sorry, I'm trying to cram everything into 30 minutes, so it's not all inclusive, but hopefully we taught you a little bit. And if you have any questions, definitely don't hesitate to contact me. Any questions currently?
Okay, this is Dr. Mark Lavlock. I'm here with Dr. Josh Jones and Dr. Richa Bedger. She's a dermatologist. Dr. Bedger, could you give us a brief background and probably a better explanation of your actual job for our listeners?
Yes. So actually, I do primary care sports medicine, and I work here in Houston with the Houston Baptist University. And so with my football players, my basketball players, even soccer, I see a lot of skin issues. So I do get a lot of experience in the dermatology realm.
So you're not a dermatologist. I misspoke.
Correct.
My apologies.
Correct.
I'm sure your friends and your colleagues are cringing right now. I apologize.
I probably have a nicer
car. You gave such a good talk. You
probably have a nicer car.
You gave such a good talk. To me, you were an expert in dermatology. So.
Dr. Bedgood, you know, we just had Dr. Bajani here, and he talked about the different routes they get into sports medicine, family practice, general medicine, PM&R, that kind of stuff. You brought up another interesting topic about primary care. So can you tell us a little bit about your education? Where did you go to medical school? What did you do your residency training? And then obviously you did a fellowship.
Yes. So I took some detours in that. I went to medical school here at UT Houston, thought I was going to be an OB-GYN, spent some time up in Brooklyn, decided I was not a surgeon, so came back and did family medicine where I felt like I didn't have to call a consult for everything because I was the one-stop shop, which I really liked about family medicine. And when I went into family medicine, I didn't realize there was a specialty of sports medicine. I had always been really interested in sports when I was younger, and I've always been a runner. I was a dancer, and so I like working with athletic people. And I actually, when I was doing OB-GYN, wanted to work with athletes from the women's health side. And so when I got into family medicine, I kind of sought out a way to do that through family medicine and learned about the primary care sports medicine training system. And I did my fellowship at Methodist Willowbrook here in Houston, up north with Dr. Scott Rand, and I just started practicing with UT Orthopedics as one of their primary care sports medicine doctors last August.
And so you're with UT Physicians?
Yes.
With Dr. Lowe and that whole group?
Correct.
So so it's very possible that our Master of Athletic Training students are going to be able to work with you because we just signed an affiliation agreement with UT Physicians Department of Orthopedic Surgery.
Yes,
so they're gonna be able to rotate.
Having athletic trainers with me, I've had some physical therapists with me, I've had a couple of residents with me, so I really enjoy having new minds hanging out with me.
So you brought up two interesting topics. Dr. Knobloch brought something up, and then you just brought something up. I want to ask you a little bit about what do you think the athletic trainer needs to know in terms of disease recognition for the skin, MRSA, et cetera. And I understand there's a VRSA coming out now, penicillin resistant.
Yes.
And then the other thing you brought up was female issues in sports medicine. The thing that pops up is the female athlete triad. So can you talk a little bit about skin disorders, what you think needs to, what we need to know as a profession, and then transition into women's health?
Absolutely. So skin issues, I mean, they run the gamut. You've got everything from your kids who are so worried because they have acne to ones who have more serious issues like the staph infections, where it can actually turn into something extremely dangerous if you don't take care of it. The biggest thing is for athletic trainers is being on the prevention side of things, really teaching athletes what they need to be doing to recognize those lesions, because they may come to you a week or 2 weeks later and say, hey, I've had this going on now for a while, and you're at the point where you're really chasing the ball there. So if you teach them, hey, I want you to bring anything suspicious to me. If you have a cut and it's just not healing the way it's supposed to, or if you have a cut or you think it's a pimple or a spider bite, you know, I need to see that sooner rather than later. At least let me lay some eyes on it so I can tell you what you need to do for it, as opposed to home remedies or, you know, trying to pop things with their nails or all those fun things that our athletes try to do to self-remedy the skin problems.
You know, Dr. Knobloch was the head athletic trainer at Lamar University for, I think, 7 years, 8 years, right? And so I'm sure he came across a lot of these different type of incidences that you talked about. Dr. Knobloch, can you elaborate on that?
Worst thing I ever saw was surprisingly just an ingrown toenail. And I remember I saw there was a book, I can't remember the name of it, it was a picture guide to dermatological issues. I mean, if you're having a bad day, look through that. Your day's not that bad when you look at some of the things in there. And to me, I was like, I never want to see this, you know, eczema. You know. But I remember the ingrown toenail was the closest I've ever come to being sick as a trainer. I don't mean that funny. I mean, it was just, you know, pretty strong stomach, but this person ingrown and it built up, for lack of a better term, pus and everything else in there. You touched and it just oozed out. And it was the worst thing ever. But toenail actually moved. And so, you know, I saw that, but I think it's key because we are not trained in, I mean, the only time we're going to see, or we're training mostly in skin injuries or skin conditions is when we see them. We don't have a formal course. Like, we have shoulder evaluation, lower leg evaluation, spine evaluation. We have pharmacology. We have general medical conditions, but skin is very small, and things like MRSA are a very big deal in athletics, and it's a very big prevention. But I think one of the things that's very key is the spread of it and the prevention of the spread of it. And you know, what else is out there that you commonly see in athletics that we don't maybe see on a daily basis, but it's a very important topic to understand?
Really, the big things, it's right, your funguses, your bacteria, like your staph that's normally on the skin, the herpes, the warts, those are going to be the big ones. And it's just a matter of which bacteria are out there at the moment. It's going to depend on where you're at. If you're in a very dry environment, you're going to have a different group of issues than if you're in a very warm, moist environment. So knowing what's around where you are. You may be more at risk for things like bites, mosquitoes, mosquito-borne illnesses in one place, whereas you're more at risk for your typical MRSA in another area. So you have to know where you're at. The big things are always going to be your staphs, and the way that we use antibiotics these days, bugs do develop resistance. And so if something's not getting better on a antibiotic, you need to realize that it's not getting better and address that, get a culture, make sure that we're throwing something else at it and not just ignoring it and letting it continue to get worse.
So would you say is it a safe assumption, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you can do all the prevention in the world and MRSA still can happen? It's not that you were, for example, you know, lack in your sanitation. It just can happen. Would you agree?
Yes. I mean, I know that people who they shower regularly, they're doing all the things that they need to, and they just have an environment that bacteria likes to grow in. So it's very individual as to who's going to be more effective than others. Everybody's the bacteria that they have living on their skin is different. It can be affected by your diet. It can be affected by, you know, your clothes. It can be affected by your family. If you come from a family that has a lot of bacterial infections, you're more likely to have it. Not only are you more likely to have it on your skin, but you're also genetically more susceptible to it. So that makes a difference.
So what are some different funguses and bacteria that you think grow in a more humid environment versus a drier environment? Obviously, because, yeah, we're originally from Southern California, and so a lot of the things that I saw when I got to Louisiana and then again here in Houston is different than what I saw in California.
I mean, I still think we see it. Well, I see a lot of your typical athletes, the Tinea pedis, Tinea corporis. I see a lot of people with it when they shave their head, very, very short hair, particularly in the summer, that they're more likely to get the fungal infections actually on the scalp. Because of those open wounds, and sometimes improper cleaning of barber equipment.
Gross.
Yeah,
you mean
exactly.
In the guy's bathroom, they don't sanitize it every time they use it?
You know, unfortunately, I have to talk with my athletes all the time. I'm like, quit rubbing your wounds together. That is not a good way to treat them. And staff is always a big one around here. I see just your typical Staph aureus is the most common one that I see. Every once in a while, we'll get some of the, we'll have random things pop up, but Staph aureus is going to be our big one.
It's always there.
Yeah.
And tell us some of the topical treatments that are out there, right? There's one in particular topical treatment that's out there for the treatment of Staph.
So I really like the bacitracin. That's my favorite. I'm not huge on the decolonization. It hasn't really been shown to do great things, particularly in athletes, but I will have them do, if they have a really bad infection, I'll have them do the bacitracin in the nose for a couple mm-hmm. days, as well as the HIPAA cleanse on the skin mm-hmm. a couple times a week, just to try and decrease the bacterial load. We're not going to get rid of all of it, but at least decrease that load somewhat so that they're less likely to get those infections.
And there are a lot of people that can't make that connection with decolonization, right? Taking the bacitracin, rubbing in the nostrils versus how does that affect, what's the correlation between my nose and my skin? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I mean, the skin is one way that we get things into our bodies, and then the respiratory system is another. And so, you know, as you're breathing things in, that's a block. It's kind of like putting up a wall to it. And it's probably, I don't know if an appropriate example, but similar to like a spermicide. Mm-hmm. It's going to block anything that's trying to come through in just a gel form. You don't necessarily need a physical barrier. You can have that antibacterial barrier that sets itself up and blocks it before it can get into the rest of the system.
Then you talk about HIPAA cleanse and Hibistat. The HIPAA cleanse, you know, always reminds me of the bright red soap. And then the Hibistat. So, you know, we have a lot of clinical athletic trainers out there that deal with staff day in and day out. Tell us a little bit from what you think. I'm an athletic trainer on the field, obviously. I don't have soap and water with me. I've got some, just general hand cleanser, and maybe I've got some Hibistat. What are some suggestions that, you know, from a clinical side to protect the clinicians?
Always wearing gloves. That's the biggest thing, is making sure that you're always wearing gloves no matter where you are. Because it may not be blood. That's the typical thing that people think of when they put on gloves, but there's lots of other body tissues and body fluids that you could be exposed to that are dangerous. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be the first line. And then both protecting you and the athlete in terms of washing your hands before and after you do any of these procedures, even if it's just with a little bit of soap and water. Soap and water did great for hundreds of years, still a really good way of cleaning your hands.
And what do you think about the combination of one part bleach, 10 parts water? You know, you have all these commercial, blood busters out there and everything to deal with bloodborne pathogens and OSHA standards. What's your take on, you know, kind of poor man's OSHA standards, one part bleach, 10 parts water?
I really like it, actually. Other than the drying aspect on the skin, if you're putting it on a skin, you want to be aware of the fact that it can dry out the skin and cause more cracks in the skin. But in terms of cleaning your equipment, I think it's great. And actually, when I have kids with ingrown toenails, I'll have them do bleach baths very early on to try and keep that from becoming a full-blown, nice, pussy toe.
We did betadine soaks. Would you recommend bleach soaks over ornithine bleach over betadine?
I haven't done a full-on study comparison in my athletes, but I've always had good results with the bleach.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I don't think we did a controlled betadine. I think they poured some in.
Yeah, that's right. That's how we used to do it.
It probably wasn't a real good study.
Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't a real good evaluator because, you know, 1 to 10 is common. Betadine is like, okay, that's enough.
Well, nowadays too, I mean, with the betadine, you get a free tan. With the bleach,
that's right.
Temporary, yes, 1 foot tan.
And I agree with you know what Dr. Knobloch said earlier was, two times I ever got, I guess, queasy or nauseous in any procedures. One was seeing an ingrown toenail procedure, and the other one was seeing a rhinoplasty. And both times when these got a little bit weak, where the podiatrist came in and, oh, we got an ingrown toenail and injected him with a 10-foot needle, and that made me a little bit queasy, and then came in with some pliers and yanked the toenail out, and I just about passed out. And the other one was when, you know, there was a patient that had fractured his nose and it was displaced, and they had to let it heal and then go back in, you know, to see how they refracture a nose. It's not, it's barbaric in nature, you know, they send this thing up your nose and then smack it with a hammer.
And some people pay for that.
Yeah, that's right.
Exactly.
Some people pay a lot of money to have
exactly.
That. So do you see, you know, and this is geared to, again, towards athletic trainers, is MRSA still the kind of the gold standard of problems, or is there a new kind of a new condition or a new strain they should kind of educate themselves on, or what's the growing trend for, you know, and I know you're not a dermatologist full-time, but what do you see? Or is it still pretty much MRSA is the big concern?
MRSA is a big concern, and we now know of good antibiotics to address it, so I don't think it's quite as scary as it was
before.
What
are some antibiotics that you'd use?
Actually, Bactrim works really well on MRSA, so which is nice in this area. But like I said, it really depends on where you're at, and most of the hospitals will have what we call a bacteriogram that shows how effective different medications are on different bugs. And that's really helpful because you may have a more resistant strain in the area that you're in. MRSA, there's always going to be new bugs that are coming that are resistant to, and you may get that culture back and it's resistant to everything except for the most simple thing. And so you're like, all right, well, we can use ampicillin on this. You know, that's great. So it's just a matter of knowing when what you're doing is not working. There's not really anything specific that's coming up in the roots that's real scary at the moment, but it's just always being adaptable with
it's
your
really
treatment.
It's really more the treatment, the more effective treatments is where the studies are probably geared. So.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, along with Dr. Knobloch just said, the, you know, I read a paper, the bacillin resistant, this Versa, which I think scared a lot of people. Oh my God, there was Versa, and now there's this Versa. What's that all about?
You know, truthfully, I haven't come across very much of it at all. It's just a different variation on the same game. Like I mentioned in my talk, the bacteria are always adjusting and trying to find ways to stay alive. And so we're always trying to find ways to kill them. So there's always the new and up and coming fancy medications, and those are not always the ones that we necessarily need to use. I prefer people to save those for the really bad infections and actually stick with the basics of what is working and what, if you have a infection and most of the team has been susceptible to one type of antibiotic, most likely this next infection is going to be susceptible to that as well because it's probably coming from the same source.
So let's talk about, just briefly, right? In your practice, your family medicine, primary care, and, you know, you have a mom, you know, kid's a high school athlete. He's got a little bit of a cold, you know, started cold on maybe Wednesday, woke up not feeling well, sore throat, stuffy nose. Needs to be able to play a game Friday night, you know, really important game. Hey, doc, can you put him on some antibiotics? What's your gold standard?
So typically, first day I see people, if it's the first day of their symptoms, it's... tell them it's really difficult to diagnose this, and so I'm not going to start you on antibiotics. We need to, most of the time this is a virus, and we need to let it kind of declare itself. If I see things that warrant antibiotics, I definitely will. There's a few instances where I will use antibiotics. Sinusitis is one of the times where it may not necessarily be a full-blown bacterial infection, but if there are certain signs like sinus tenderness in the frontal or the maxillary sinuses, I will do an antibiotic because of the risk associated with a really bad sinusitis getting into the from the sinus to the brains is not a very long trip, so I'll usually err on the side of precaution with that. And the Z-Pak, it's not good for a lot of other things, but it is great for that. So that's the one time where I will take care of that. But if people are concerned, they come in, they always, oh, I've got a sore throat, I'm worried that I have strep. Well, if you don't have one of the you know, three out of the four signs in no cough, fever, tender lymphadenopathy, and exudates, I'm not giving you an antibiotic because it doesn't meet the criteria, and it's going to be a waste of your money, and it's going to put other people at risk in the long run.
Because, you know, as you're exposed to this antibiotic that you don't need, it really starts to make more resistant to the, right? And that's where we get to methicillin resistant.
Absolutely. And it also, you know, you're putting things in your body has to process that you don't need. And so you never know when you're going to have an allergic reaction to a medication. So you're taking a risk there by taking something that you don't need and that's not going to help you.
So is there a time period? I remember going through grad school and our head athletic trainer had said, you know, it's really 7 days worth of without. And I said, well, you know, what does that mean? He says, you know, if somebody comes to you with a cold, you know, let's say you're on the road with a team, give it 7 days, you know, with it. You know, give it 7 days to run its course, and that course will dictate what it is. And with or without means antibiotic, no antibiotic. So just let that week go by. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. If it's gone on longer than 7 days, it's much more likely to be a bacterial infection than a virus. Viruses are going to run their course. And if you're still having symptoms at 7 days, I actually say it's either allergies or bacteria.
A bacteria.
Yeah. In Houston, we definitely have to throw that allergies into the mix. These people who come in and have been feeling horrible for the last 3 weeks. Okay, that's because your nose is inflamed and it's dripping down the back of your throat and your eyes are all nice and itchy. That's not strep throat.
I like that diagnosis better than what I was taught, which was if it's clear, it's a virus. If it's colored, it's a bacteria. I said, I don't think it's that simple. I mean, I could be wrong, but.
And I try not to look at, you know, nasal drainage that closely. So.
go back for a second. You talked a little bit about recognizing the signs of a bacterial infection. So you have an athletic trainer that travel with the team. Let's say they've got a long road, 2 week road trip, right? And they've got to be able to talk to you as the team physician, but you're really relying on them on what they're going to see. And athletic trainers, you know, the new generation now is trained to use an otoscope and use an ophthalmoscope and be able to use some of these tools and report back to you and say, hey, look, doc, this is really what it is. So what are some cardinal signs of that bacterial infection?
So, you know, it really depends on where you're looking. So if you're looking in the throat, you're looking for the exudate, you're looking for a lot of erythema, your fevers, how long it's been going on. In skin, you're looking for the redness or the warmth around the side of it. Is it increasing? Is it staying the same? Stomach bugs generally are not bacterial unless you're just having really, really special types of diarrhea. You know, your urinary tract infections, those are pretty much always bacterial, and so knowing what the signs and symptoms of a urinary tract infection are important. But the majority of things are, you just have to go in with the knowledge that the majority of things are viral. Pink eye, pretty much always viral.
Understand. So if, you know, we're going to be educating or students on some of these things that they need to see in the general medical condition, or Dr. Knobloch is teaching our emergency care class and some other things. And you can learn more about our curriculum for our program at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. And we want to thank Dr. Bedgood for all of her time and expertise. I think we're getting the sign to wrap up here.
Yeah, it's from our sponsors, so we have no choice.
Yes, we have no choice. We have to wrap up.
We would like to thank Pasadena High School for putting this on as well, opportunity to spread some knowledge here.
Yeah, Bill and Jeremy are doing an excellent job over there. Jasmine, she's doing a great job. for the sports medicine broadcast and the Master of Athletic Training Program at the University of Houston at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. You can look us up. We have our own Twitter now, at U of HMAT. Catch us on Facebook. You can look us up on Sports Medicine Broadcast. Also, look at the Twitter page for the Sports Medicine Broadcast and the Sports Medicine Update here at Memorial Hermann. I'm Dr. Josh Yellen, Dr. Mark Knobloch, and Dr. Alicia Pettigrew. Thank you very much.